The first case for oral argument this morning is Lois Johnson versus Leonard Johnson. For the appellant, Lois Johnson is Victoria Doerr, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellee, Leonard Johnson is Mr. Gregory T. Brewers, an attorney also from Sioux Falls. Ms. Doerr, you may proceed and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court and counsel, I'm here today and I represent Lois Johnson. Lois Johnson is requesting that this court reverse and remand the decision of the trial court as it relates to the property division. It is Lois's position that the trial court erred in the property division by granting a substantial portion of the marital estate to Leonard, which is also known as Pete Johnson. Lois and Pete were married for approximately 33 years. At the time of the marriage, Pete was farming and Lois was a federal employee with the Department of Veterans Affairs. Premarital was not an issue in this case. Lois continued to work at the Veterans Affairs during the first part of their marriage. She took a six-year hiatus, basically, to have their three children. She returned to the Veterans Affairs Department and continued to work there until the time of the divorce. She was part-time until later on, and then she went back to full-time. Also, while part-time at the Veterans Affairs, she worked at Sioux Valley Hospital one day a week and also cleaned houses. She continued to clean houses until 3 years before the divorce.
And all that money that she earned went into the family coffers, then, right?
Correct. They did have separate checking accounts, but he paid certain things, she paid certain things. She was the primary person responsible for the kids, made sure they had their lunch meals and clothes and activities and so forth. So in addition to Lois working her outside job and helping on the farm, she also was the primary parent running the children around as well. He continued to farm. The important part of Lois's employment that's going to be significant in this case is the fact that she started as a federal employee early enough so that she was a member of the Civil Service Retirement System. When an individual is a member of the Civil Service Retirement System, which is the acronym is CSRS, she does not participate in the Social Security benefit program by the federal government. Wherein Pete, his earnings were reported from the farm, and he then received Social Security.
Was her plan a contributory plan?
No. The CSRS is not.
So she contributed. None of the marital estate was used then to fund that.
Correct.
But there would have been 15% approximately of the farm income would have gone to the Social Security benefit.
You are correct on that. She was involved in the CSRS, which is one of the primary assets. There were two other thrift savings funds. That dollar value, that is contributory, but that's separate than the CSRS. And those values are as they were assigned by the court. There's an easy assignment to those values. Approximately 1 year after the parties married, Pete entered into a contract with his parents to purchase this farm. The payment was $32,000, and then they were to pay the premiums on a $100,000 life insurance policy. That $100,000 life insurance policy at the time of his father's death was then paid over to Pete's mother as payment for the farm. The farm land was one of the significant assets that was valued over $1 million. The parties did not dispute the value of that farm, and Pete did not make any claim that any of it should be excluded as gift or inherited or premarital or anything to that effect. The premiums for the life insurance policy and the $32,000 payment were all made out of the family coffers, the farming income. Another significant event that occurred during the party's marriage was an automobile accident. Both parties were involved in the automobile accident. However, Lois received minor injuries, nothing of significance. Pete, on the other hand, received a significant injury. He wasn't in the hospital overnight, but it involved an operation on his shoulder. He also had some nerve damage that caused headaches. As a result of that, there was a jury, and the verdict was significant. The parties settled for just under $800,000 on appeal. The net basically to the clients was $480,000. It is our position that that should all be included. So the assets that were a significant value for this marriage is the farmland, the farm assets, the CSRS retirement account, and then the personal injury settlement. And it's our position, the court, when it looked at all those assets and some of the errors that they made, even with the errors that they made, the court still did an inequitable distribution. The court ordered that Leonard Pete Johnson pay to Lois $300,000 to make an equitable adjustment. After the $300,000 payment, Pete would still have a net estate over $1 million. He'd have $1,049,784. After the $300,000 payment, Lois would receive a net estate of $806,687.
Do those figures take into consideration the amount of her retirement as opposed to his retirement?
It included her entire retirement. In fact, we both had experts that valued it. The Pete's expert put a value of $354,000 on it. My expert had a value of $315,000. The difference between the values was the discount rate that was applied by the two experts. That was the only difference. And you have to remember that the $300,000, whether you $315,000 or $354,000, that is not guaranteed. In order for Lois to reap the full benefit of that $300,000 asset, she would have to live another 24 and a half years. So she would have to be 82 and a half years old in order to reap the full benefit. So it's not guaranteed.
Was it discounted to present value?
Yes, it was. That's the discounted present value.
Okay. And that problem, though, is inherent in any defined contribution plan, or you have that problem. And we've never found a trial court abusing its discretion doing that. I think the issue I want to hear from you about is the Social Security, because that was not included in the estate, and I want to know from you why the court should be able to do indirectly what they can't do directly with respect to that Social Security.
Yes, and that's what I thought the court was most interested in hearing about, is the Social Security issue. And you are correct in that the 42 USCS Section 407A prohibits Social Security benefits from being an asset in a marital division. However, there are several courts that have addressed this issue as to whether or not you can make some adjustments for it. Now, the initial court that prompted some of the inquiries regarding whether or not Social Security could or could not, and if you could kind of bypass the statute, the court was Hisquerdo versus Hisquerdo, 439 U.S. 572. That was the initial court, but that was railroad retirement.
I got to stop you right there, though, because you said if you get by the statute or excuse the statute, that's the problem here.
Right. You are correct, Your Honor.
You can't ignore a federal statute.
You are correct in that, but the majority of the courts have actually determined that it is a factor that can be considered. In a 2006 case from Maine, Depot versus Depot, at 893 A second 995, addressed the statute. And the statute, the federal statute, it's an anti-assignment statute where you're not supposed to assign the proceeds to another person. The other provision of that statute that makes it difficult that excludes the Social Security benefits is a prohibition against subjecting the monies paid or payable or rights existing under this chapter to execution, levy, attachment, garnishment, or other legal process, or to the operation of any bankruptcy or insolvency law. After Hisquerdo, the Supreme Court in Washington State Department of Social and Health Services versus Guardianship Estate of Keffler, 537 U.S. 371.
Are those cases cited in your brief,
counsel? No,
counsel?
They are not, Your Honor.
Then under our court rules, you have to provide, was it 8 copies?
15, isn't it?
15. 15 copies to the clerk's office.
Okay, I can submit those.
And in case you cite the sentence in your brief, that rule applies to.
Okay. And the defined other legal process should be understood to be processed much like the process of execution, levy, attachment, and garnishment, and at a minimum would seem to require utilization of some judicial or quasi-judicial mechanism, though not necessarily an elaborate one, by which control over property passes from one person to another in order to discharge or secure discharge of allegedly existing or anticipated liability. In Depot versus Depot, they interpreted this to state that treatment of a spouse's social anticipated or actual Social Security benefit payments is a factor relevant to the equitable distribution of property is neither a judicial process, much like the process of execution, levy, attachment, or garnishment, nor is it a mechanism by which control over Social Security benefits passes from one person to another. The other, if you look at the long line of cases, there's a distinction also in whether or not there is only Social Security benefits. And then they look at it as a factor. In Morehouse versus Morehouse, again, that's another case I'll have to provide to the court. 121 P3rd 264, it's a Colorado 2005 case. That is a case where they did not have anything other than Social Security benefits. And they said that, and they acknowledged you can't do an offset, you can't transfer Social Security benefits. But what they said is you could look at it in an equitable fashion, and instead of maybe doing a 50-50 split, you would do a 60-40 split. There are cases, though, wherein if the participant is involved in a retirement program wherein the CSRS, similar to the CSRS, which prohibits them from participating in the Social Security benefit program, they have allowed for an offset. And there's two different approaches in which courts have utilized to do this.
Let's assume you've gotten by the statute, and let's assume we're talking about the trial court can still exercise a discretion in determining the award, right?
Correct.
All right. Now, how did the trial court judge err in the award that he made to Pete and to her?
His error was he said there was insufficient evidence. And I don't know if you're familiar. When you, before you reach the age of retirement, you get the Social Security statements, the white statement with the green stripe, and it tells you what you've earned and what your projected Social Security retirement will be at the time of retirement, what your payment will be. Pete Johnson already started receiving Social Security benefits. So Pete Johnson no longer received that statement. Instead, what Pete Johnson received was an actual statement what he was receiving. And that statement was provided to the court and to our expert to arrive at his present-day value calculation.
And that amounts to what?
The $115,000 was the present-day value calculation of Pete Johnson's Social Security statement.
So was that included in the amount that was awarded to Pete?
No.
So he has his award plus the Social Security. And she has a total of how much after the offset, after the payment to equalize?
After the payment to equal, if...
In other words, didn't she get $500,000?
She...
Plus a $300,000
right.
offset.
Right.
Which brings him down to 1 point, to 0.9, right? Or 900,000?
No, he actually stayed, after the $300,000 payment, he still was over $1 million. Plus his 115, so he is probably at 115, the 1,049 plus the 115, so he is close to 1.2. Wherein she was at 800,000.
How much of that $1 million is subject to capital gain tax?
Mr. Johnson did not present any evidence in regards to capital gains.
Well, he got the land, right?
He did get the land.
Well, you know that's all going to be subject
right.
to capital gain, and the cash he gets isn't, right?
Correct. There will be capital gains on his account, yes.
And we've recognized in previous cases that's a proper consideration.
Correct, but when you look at the trial court's decision, the trial court did bring that up as an issue at the time of the trial, but in review of the entire trial court's memorandum opinion, which is attached, did not appear to be a factor. It was not mentioned by the trial court in arriving in the distribution.
From your review of the record, what's the tax basis for the land?
I don't know what it is.
How do we know that the trial court didn't consider this as a factor? He does mention it, that it is not, he will not offset Pete's Social Security benefit against Lois's CSRS plan. That would indicate, since he put it in the findings of fact, that at least he did consider it as a factor of one sort or another and rejected it.
But if you look at the memorandum opinion that he submitted, which was an extensive memorandum opinion, his reason, he did...
Was that included in your, is that
that's attached
incorporated? Is that incorporated in the findings of fact?
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about the personal injury award. Mm-hmm. Apparently we don't have a specific case in South Dakota that deals specifically with what the judge did here.
Correct.
The judge here, apparently there's two theories on how to distribute, to divide a personal injury award. One is the mechanical approach and one is the analytical approach. Aside from your client's particular facts, which is the better approach? I can see cases where one spouse is severely injured and shouldn't have to have that divided 50-50 in a divorce when they may need that for their disability. How do we do that? Which plan is better for South Dakota?
Yeah, I think the plan that requires the court to utilize all the seven factors, and that's what this court... precedence is. In Heinrichs v. Heinrichs, the precedent was that you looked at all the factors, the seven factors that basically guide the property division in determining whether or not that personal injury award should or should not be included. And
the seven factors are generally applied to making a division. The question here is whether the property should be in or out of the estate to be divided. And we traditionally look at different factors, like the Billion case, to make that decision.
In my position, Your Honor, you should continue to apply those factors in determining whether or not this asset for these parties should be included in the marital estate. And it is our position that it should be included in the marital estate.
But to follow up on Justice Konenkamp's question, you know, what we decide in this case is going to probably be the rule in South Dakota. And what about his example where one of the spouses is severely injured and is going to have long-term pain and suffering? Shouldn't the analytical approach be used in that kind of a situation to give that spouse the benefit that she or he will need?
Yes, but I still think you need to look at those factors. And in this case, those facts aren't present. For this case, Mr. Johnson himself testified that he does not have any residual effects.
So what would you do then? You mean you use the analytical approach for some cases and the mechanical approach for other cases?
I think if you use the mechanical approach that you'll be able to utilize all those factors and continue to analyze. Mark, if you use that approach, then you'll be able to look at those factors and take that into consideration on a case-by-case basis.
2 minutes.
Why is it an abuse of discretion to use one approach rather than the other in each particular case as the facts may justify? Why would that be an abuse of discretion for Judge Keene to use either one of them here?
Your Honor, because I think that there was an abuse of discretion in that Mr. Johnson does not continue to have any of the lingering effects from his injury. The other factor that is... this court has stated is significant in Heinrichs v. Heinrichs is whether or not those assets have been commingled. And in this case, those assets have been commingled. The facts to this case are very similar to Heinrichs, almost to the T.
But Judge Keene looked at the commingled. He considered the commingling. His opinion makes it very clear he did consider that.
He did, Your Honor, but I do believe he... still excluded some of the assets for pain and suffering, which Mr. Johnson himself no longer has. And so that, I believe, would be an abuse of discretion.
Does the trial court here have the authority to go in and set aside a previous agreement between the parties that this was a pain and suffering compensation?
Does a trial court...
In a divorce.
Yes.
Isn't that already some kind of res judicata? We've got a jury trial on it. The jury made a decision. Award was made, and a settlement was agreed to post-verdict. How does the trial court and the divorce get authority to go in and reallocate that?
Well, I think you're allocating it as a marital, you're reallocating it as a marital asset. And that is how this court has treated it. And that's why I believe that the entire award should have been included in this case.
Your time has expired. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Brewers, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. I think the court has probably identified the two biggest issues in terms of the questioning that has already gone on, and I would like to basically jump right to some of those issues in particular regarding the Social Security offset issues against the civil service retirement system. In the past, it's very clear that this court and just about every other court that I have come across seems to indicate that retirement benefits are subject to a marital division in any divorce action. That applies to the civil service retirement system because Congress has basically said it can apply. Congress, however, has, for various reasons, carved out Social Security and said, we draw the line here.
Well, your opponent, though, said that's basically an anti-assignment statute, which to me is a little bit different than saying that it's something that can't be considered as far as an equitable distribution of marital assets.
I believe the court and Congress has gone, the U.S. Supreme Court has gone a little bit farther in explaining some of the statutes. Congress in 1975 basically said that they were carving out two exceptions. One was for child support, and one was for spousal support or alimony. That spousal support and alimony apparently didn't quite satisfy Congress because 2 years later, in 1977, Congress went back in and said, we're going to be even more specific here. And in the definition of alimony, what it said was, we are specifically saying spousal support, and we are specifically excluding the division of property. So I think Congress has, in fact, seen this loophole and tried to fill it. That particular statute was, it has jumped around. The location of the definition of alimony has jumped around a little bit over the years. I believe it started in a section of 42 U.S.C. 462, and then it was moved to a section 42 U.S.C. 662, and finally, if you were looking for it today, it's in 42 U.S.C. 659, and in fact, that language has been addressed in the Esquardo decision, and also back in a case of McCarty versus McCarty, both U.S. Supreme Court cases cited in my brief. And what the court was doing at that time was saying, look, we understand that on the surface it may appear to be somewhat inequitable. However, Congress had two purposes in mind. First, they were concerned about protecting the individual contributant's Social Security return upon retirement, protection through old age. And I think the second thing was the court was recognizing that Congress viewed it as very important that in certain cases or circumstances, we want to encourage as public policy people to retire and feel secure enough in their retirement to actually make that decision that they're going to stop working.
Well, neither of those purposes would be frustrated in this case if the $100,000 approximately present value of the Social Security benefit was considered a part, indirectly considered in dividing the estate. I mean, this gentleman is not going to be hurting if that $100,000, $115,000 or whatever it was, is transferred over or divided indirectly.
I guess the loss of that money when a person is already 65 years old and has a lot of health problems in terms of how much he can actively participate in his own farming operation, his only career throughout his life, I guess I'm not willing to say that it doesn't make a difference to Pete Johnson in this, under these circumstances. I think he believes that the farming operation needs to continue. It's his way of not only providing for himself, but also satisfying his obligations under the divorce decree.
Well, with the $2 million marital corpus here, I don't think either one of them are going to go hungry, no matter which way we decide. But there are a lot of people in this world that are living on Social Security and nothing else. What would happen if that situation, we were faced with a divorce, one person's getting Social Security, the other isn't? Are we precluded, or the court system, from awarding the other person alimony or some type of support and saying, well, you get all Social Security, and I hate to tell you this, but you get nothing?
No, I don't think so. That's not what we are suggesting, and I don't think Congress was suggesting that either.
That especially shouldn't be the rule, where here, as a wife, she worked on the farm for several years and contributed to the Social Security that's in his name, right?
She did. Her involvement basically stopped about 25 years ago. Now, granted, she was a housewife. She continued to take care of the kids, and they both were contributing to various aspects of the living expenses.
But there's no question that more than 15% of the income of the joint property of these parties throughout the marriage was going to that Social Security benefit. And I mean, that's, she was just as much a part of that as he was.
Correct, Your Honor. What I think, you know, keeps sort of eluding the appellant's argument is that they had a way to try and address any inequities that they felt might exist. And I think that avenue would have been by pursuing alimony. Because Social Security is a matter of income.
Why can't they do it through property distribution?
Well, first and foremost, because Congress said you can't.
No, but we're talking about making it, without regard to the principal rule, we're talking about making an equitable division of the property. I mean, you don't have to do it through alimony, as you just indicated, is my point.
Well, but what we are dealing with in terms of Social Security is, in fact, income. And I think it makes most sense to address income when we address alimony. And that, I think, is one of the things that the Supreme Court has touched upon in those early cases of McCarty and Pisquardo, was that the protections that Congress set up did have an avenue to address the income potential. That income potential, I think, is something that there could be a lot of different examples where it would seem like you're going to then start wanting to pull in Social Security benefits.
I don't mean to argue with you on that, but here the trial court clearly treated it more in a property sense, didn't he?
Correct.
Because he considered what it, the time value of the money, or he considered the present value of both hers and the Social Security as to what the amount was.
The court accepted on an offer of proof Lois Johnson's expert's opinion that the present value of Social Security for Pete would have been $115,000, and for Lois would have been, I believe, $88,000.
But it's not quite as simple as treated in, as alimony rather than property, because there's many cases where alimony is not justified. It wouldn't be justified under state law. In fact, in this case might be an example where, I mean, you couldn't do it in any fashion then, because alimony wouldn't be justified under state law factors.
I think that's a potential, but I think the it would be a fairly unique situation where you're basically saying that you should take Social Security from one spouse when there isn't already the, in this case, civil service retirement system money available. If you were going to be giving alimony based strictly on Social Security, I think it would be hard-pressed to probably find the right factors to do that.
Was the trial court obligated to put the entire value of her retirement into the marital estate? Or could the would the trial court have had discretion to carve out part of it? For instance, carve out the part that might be in lieu of the Social Security that she will not receive herself?
I believe that's the same prohibition that the Hisguardo and McCarty cases said you can't do. I do think the trial court
not to take his amount and reduce hers, but to take the amount she would have received if she was also eligible for Social Security, which would normally have been not included in the marital estate. Correct?
Yes.
But so she does not get Social Security. She only gets the retirement, and that all goes into the estate. She does not get the benefit of having part of her retirement, which would have been Social Security, eliminated from the estate. So would he have been able to do any adjusting in that regard? Not so much looking at his retirement or his Social Security, but looking at what she might have received.
That is an approach that some courts have, in fact, tried to do. And in fact, the appellant cited a couple of cases in their brief that tried to use that approach. We think that is doing exactly what is prohibited by Congress. If you're going to do that in a case such as this, why wouldn't you open up Social Security on all fronts?
Well, wait a minute. Now, the trial court also set aside its non-marital assets, part of your client's personal injury award.
Correct.
That has that kind of authority. Why can't it say, in the matter of fairness and equity, if we're not going to put the Social Security in, as Justice Meyer Henry has indicated, we're also not going to put that other federal pension in either?
Well, I think the trial court has discretion to
do these type of things. What? Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I think the trial court does have discretion to do those type of things. And getting back to Justice Meyer Henry's comments, I think there are some situations where a court would probably exclude portions of the retirement that was offered into the civil service retirement system. In this particular case, Judge Keene went through all of the factors. He did a very detailed analysis of how the assets are actually structured. This is what he thought was fair. There are other issues, I guess, that I could bring up. In terms of the trial transcript, there was also testimony where, in fact, if you were just using the current discount rate, the current value of that account, it would have been over $400,000. But a five-year discount rate resulted in $354,000. Using a 10-year period, it was $315,000. So I think the court did try to fashion out something that he thought was equitable under the circumstances. I don't think it would be consistent with this court's prior decisions to simply say we are going to only consider part of an asset when there isn't justification to demonstrate that that is not a marital asset. And in this case, there was no justification offered at the time of trial by Lois Johnson. In fact, it was interesting that the offer of proof regarding what Lois Johnson's Social Security would have been, presumably how much present value would her Social Security have if she had been contributing. That was $88,000. This is an account that has a present-day value of $354,000. If we were going to try to demonstrate the basis of that $88,000 Social Security contribution, the evidence should have included a detailed history of what the contributions were during Lois's lifetime. That's the only way to get to the actual calculation. That was not done. It was not offered. I think another confusing point that the appellant brings out is the issue of what the court, the trial court, Judge Keene, found lacking in terms of some of the support. And what he said was, I don't think you can get past the federal statutes in the first place, but even let's assume that you did. There's no detailed history of what her earnings would be.
But there was direct evidence of the present value of the Social Security benefit. So I don't understand. That's the one part of Judge Keene's decision I don't understand. Was he in error when he said, there's no evidence in front of me on the value of this Social Security plan?
The only thing he had was an opinion offered as part of a proffer of proof.
But that's sufficient. I mean, we all know, according to the offer, it was $115,000 approximately. So there was evidence of the value, and it looks like Judge Keene may have erred, at least in that respect, in saying there's no evidence, therefore I can't divide it.
One of the things that the $115,000 was based on is all they did was basically take his Social Security payments, $851 per month, which are reduced by Medicaid, but they basically just used that number, and they never went back and tried to figure out what he had earned in each year, for instance, during the marriage.
Why is that important? I mean, 851.20 is a real number. That's what he gets per month, right?
Correct. Some of it would have been premarital.
Okay.
In a marriage of this length, you're going to divide that out?
How many years did he work before he got married 33 years ago?
33 years prior to trial, he would have been approximately 32. He would have been 32 years old. So
he might
he
have
started
10,
farming
12
when
years.
He was in high school.
There's one other thing in the briefs that I wanted to do, relatively minor compared to what the numbers we're talking about, but the wife here complains that the trial court double-charged her with respect to a tax refund. She received a tax refund of $3,000-some-odd. The court took credit for that and then looked at her checking account and then counted it again because it was in her checking account. What is your response to that?
I don't think it was in the checking account, and it was an asset that had been basically distributed during the pendency of the divorce proceedings. He was also credited with approximately $5,000, maybe $5,500.
Well, I understand. They each were credited, but her complaint is that she was double charged for it. She received it, and the court charged her for that, and then she put it in her checking account, and the court found that that was an asset, so he charged her again against her share for it.
The same situation would have happened with Pete. We had the value of his checking accounts, and he was also credited with the same tax refund that came back.
2 minutes.
Thank you. I have not taken much time, any time, to discuss the personal injury issue. Some of the comments or questions that came during appellant's portion talked about the analytical versus mechanical approach. We think Judge Keene did a thorough job of trying to sort that out. He did put a substantial amount of those personal injury proceeds into the marital estate. In fact, about 59% of them went into the marital estate, and a portion, about 7.5%, was set aside strictly for Lois.
Now, did he use the analytical approach?
He did. And what he did was follow a case, Pardee, versus Party, cited in the brief, regarding a personal injury case down in Nebraska. And in that case, the court analyzed how these two approaches have been viewed, finding that the analytical approach is the majority view.
And do you agree with that?
Absolutely. The mechanical approach leaves a whole lot of void. All it really does is say whether or not it's in or out. It doesn't say what's in, what's out, and it does not relate to the type of factors that would govern division of property, such as the accumulation of the property. The mechanical approach, unlike what I think the appellant was arguing, is entirely, I think, it just doesn't give any guidance. It just says, take a look at it, consider it, see whether it's been commingled. Well, Judge Keene's approach and the analytical approach went many steps farther and said, I'm looking at all of these factors in terms of the property division, but I'm also looking at who actually is suffering, who actually was compensated as part of the process. And since the court had good information regarding the loss of consortium claim that Lois Johnson had, and also Pete's physical injuries, I think the court did an excellent job of trying to ferret that out, considering that some assets were in fact commingled, and doing what he could to be as equitable as possible.
Thank you, Counsel. Your time has expired. Ms. Doerr, you have 10 minutes.
Mr. Brewer's made a comment that her contribution to the family farm ended 25 years ago, and I guess I would take difference with that. She continued to work on the farm. Did she work as much as Pete Johnson on the farm? No, but she also held down a full-time job, a part-time job, and continued to do house cleaning and raise three children. And this court has clearly recognized that that is contribution to the development of the marital estate. And so for that reason, I think she is entitled to an equitable distribution, and I don't think the court did an equitable distribution here. In regards to on the Social Security issue, the minority...
Before you go there, let's just go back to, okay, you say it's not an equitable division. All right. What is the difference that it would take to make it an equitable division? And why?
Your Honor, in my assumption, she should have a payment of approximately $500,000 rather than $300,000. In addition to the differences in what the judge came up with marital estates, there are also several errors that the court made in his calculations. As Justice Konenkamp already pointed out, there was the double counting of the tax refund. In addition to that, there were at least $18,000 for pasture rent, vet expenses, and one other item that the defendant himself agreed should not be included as marital debts. The parties had reached an agreement wherein when the operating loan was paid off, which was January 14th of 2005, she would not be responsible for any further debt, nor would she be entitled to any of the additional assets that accumulated on the farm after that date. The defendant himself acknowledged that those three item entries were for 2005 assets and should not be included. The judge included them. There was also $15,000 that the judge included off from line 43 of the Exhibit 35, I believe, for a line of credit. And there wasn't, that was not an accurate, that line entry was proceeds that he had received. What my client was proposing, she had an appraisal done on December 18th of 2004. That was the closest appraisal to the January 14th, 2005 date. But she acknowledged that some of those items that were appraised, particularly livestock or feed, had been sold from December 18th to January 14th in order to make that operating loan a zero balance.
But you know, all these details now, in light of what Justice Savers just asked, they all seem inconsequential. We've never required a 50% division And here on an estate in excess of $2 million, it sounds not like we're arguing about $200,000, and we routinely affirm property divisions that might be off 10%.
I acknowledge that, Your Honor, but I do think that this court needs to look at the issues that are presented, particularly the Social Security issue. I think it is time for this court to address that Social Security issue, and I think it's an important issue for this court to rule on. There are several courts in the United States that have already addressed that, and according to the Moorhead v. Moorhead decision, or Morehouse versus Morehouse, the majority of the courts are allowing that factor, the Social Security benefit factor, to be taken into consideration.
Well, say you win on that issue, so then I think your figures, he's got $1.2 million, she's got $800,000. Would that be equitable?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it should be in this case. I think it's inequitable in the fact that my client has contributed a significant amount to this marriage. And I
think she gets $800,000. That's not pocket change.
I understand that.
And it looks like it's mostly tax-free assets.
Yes, but he's also getting the income-producing asset that he is receiving. She's not receiving that. And so I think that's also a significant factor the court needs to take into consideration.
So aren't you really advocating a 50-50 split here?
I would be advocating 50-50 split unless the court adopts the Morehouse versus Morehouse decision, wherein in order to make an adjustment for the Social Security benefit, instead of doing a direct offset, such as they did in the hypothetical approach in Kelly versus Kelly, which was the approach that Justice Meyer Henry was talking about, wherein they figure what Lois's Social Security benefit would have been, and they reduce that from her Social Security. The problem with that, the courts have found, is if you have a situation where you've had a stay-at-home mom, you're now reducing his retirement account by his Social Security, but yet she doesn't have any offsetting Social Security. And that's why at the trial court level, we propose Eichelberger approach set forth in Harshberger versus Harshberger, wherein you look at what the non-CSRS spouse's Social Security benefit would have been. And I would disagree with Mr. Brewers in that regard. Her statement to arrive at her Social Security $88,000 present day value, that was admitted. Exhibit 3 was her Social Security statement, and Exhibit 4 was a benefit calculator as to how to arrive at that figure. We requested that white sheet with the green stripe Social Security statement for Mr. Johnson, and it was not provided to us because we were informed that it did not exist. Instead, they gave us the only statement that we provided to the court, which set forth what his actual value was that he was receiving. But if the court doesn't use either the hypothetical or the Eichelberger approach, and instead utilizes the equitable approach set forth in Morehouse, then I think in order to adjust for that Social Security benefit factor, you need to do more than 50% to Lois Johnson. I realize in Grove versus Goro, the court does not require a mathematical precision. However, when you look at the seven factors, I think that the court should award at least a 50-50 split to Lois in this case. The court, as I indicated, acknowledged the wife's contribution, even from outside income, as contribution to building the marital estate. If you look at the trial court's memorandum opinion, he continues to refer to her. She didn't do as much on the farm, so maybe she shouldn't be entitled to as much to the farm, because she returned to her city job. And he referred to her city job a couple times, and I don't think that it's right to, and I don't think this court has stated that you can exclude contributions to the entire marital estate because she's worked in outside income. And the court has specifically included an outside income as, recognized outside income as contribution to the marital estate. In Garnos v. Garnos, in Prentice v. Prentice.
Well, she wasn't setting aside, when she brought her check home, she wasn't setting it aside just for herself. It went into the family farm business.
You are correct. It went into paying light bills and heat bills and paid for the food for the family and paid for the children's activities.
Two months.
I mean, thank you, Your Honor. He would pay for cattle or such, but she paid to keep the household running. In fact, the court, when she wasn't working that outside income, granted there were other outside factors such as the hail to the crops and just farm prices in general in the early 1980s, but when she wasn't working that outside income, these parties had to file bankruptcy.
Why was it so important for the court to try and keep the farm intact? Go ahead and answer that question. I'll ask next.
I'm not sure because we never requested that the court split up the farm.
That was my question. So
no.
Your client did not ask for a PHUD, some of the land to be sold or some assets to be sold so she could have her share immediately.
No, we did not. The farmland is set up such that could occur. In fact, I think there's parcels A, B, and C, and one parcel actually is already subdivided for some sales. This farmland is out by Garrettson, so Sioux Falls is not too far from there. So it is possible. In fact, their son has a realtor license, and he had already subdivided one of the parcels to do that. But we did not ask the court to do that. In any event, Your Honor, I would ask that the court find that the trial court's valuations, were clearly in error in that the court included marital debt that was not marital debt, and in the end it was an inequitable division by granting him a substantially greater portion and not including some type of factor in adjusting for the Social Security benefit. So we would ask that you reverse and remand this court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dorff. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.